This is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We gonna go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers. Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways.
And Adam Nathan.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in.
We are going to follow you. You lead us, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Go Hawks.
Yep, welcome yet again to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the one, only, and official UK Seahawkers podcast. This week we will cover everything that happened in the Motor City Sunday evening, which was a lot of fun for all us Seahawks fans, before looking ahead to what lies ahead this week back in the home comforts of Century Link Field as the Chargers roll into town. Everything else as well in the NFL, including... We bid a fond farewell to someone who has been a podcast stalwart through that. Myself, Stuart Court, is, as ever, joined by Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm good. I've just walked in from the 60,000-person caravan, a.k.a. the London Stadium, home of West Ham.
Is that the caravan that's in Guatemala somewhere?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, may as well be so far away from the pitch. You may as well be. But West Ham have been dealt another lesson by the mighty Spurs this evening. So all is ever so well, and another cup final goes begging for West Ham. Sad times. I'm ever so well,
and a pretty tasty draw as well.
Indeed. Another from one filth to another.
Before we get on to what was, as I said, a fun Sunday evening for the Seahawks and everything else on this week's episode, we start, unfortunately, again on a somber note. Earlier today, news broke by a former Seahawks wide receiver and now voice of the team, Steve Rabel, that Jack Patera, the team's first ever head coach upon their first season and inception back in 1976, has died at the age of 85. Patera led the team from its birth for the first 6 years, highlighted by winning the NFL Coach of the Year after the franchise's first ever winning season in 1978. The Seahawks was his only head coaching gig and a final stop on his 27-year career as a player and coach in the league after being a fourth-round pick out of Oregon in 1955. Here is Jack himself talking in 2016 about how he got the job as the first franchise head coach.
You know, I found out that the Seahawks had been awarded a franchise, and that John Thompson was the managing whatever. I think Herman was the managing general partner, and John was maybe his general manager. I forget the titles. But I thought about it. You know, I'd been an assistant coach, and I never really wanted to be a coach, but I worked my way into it, that type of thing. So I wrote a letter to John. And I'd known him. He was with the Vikings when I was there, and then he went to the main office. And so when I went to the Giants, I would get together with John. So I wrote a letter to John. Never heard a word. Well, you know, it's just one of those things. And we were in the playoffs. Minnesota was playing Texas or Dallas. And Herman and John called me the night before.
I had a feeling that might happen.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Herman and John called me the night before and wanted to talk to me after the game about this job. And, I mean, it was just that, you know, I'd never had any warning or anything else. I said, well, sure. So we went out to dinner and we were talking. Oh, excuse me. And we'd had dinner. We're still talking a little bit. And Herman turns to John and he says, John, I think we found our coach. This is the only interview I ever had with him. And he'd been interviewing people, you know, I know a lot of coaches that had applied for the job that had been interviewed. So when I went home, you know, my wife says, well, how'd it go? I says, I think I'm hired. So it happened just that fast.
So another very sad day for the organisation and its fan base. So here from everyone, the UK Seahawkers and our, this podcast, Pedestrian Podcast, rest in peace to Jack Patera.
A complete remodel for Seattle. To the air goes Russell Wilson looking in the end zone. Lockett is there. He's got it for a touchdown. What a throw. What a catch. Shield in Detroit. Abdullah zigging and zagging his way across the 30, but he fumbles the football. It's been a problem for Abdullah in his career. The ball coughed up. Seattle looks like they've got it. Tedrick Thompson with the rip. Wilson looking for Moore. Juggles, makes the catch. Touchdown. David Moore's fourth touchdown grab of the year. The highest degree of difficulty. Wilson with all kinds of time to the end zone, juggling for Dixon, who's got it for the touchdown. Welcome back, Ed Dixon. Chris Carson with the carry. And Carson going into the end zone for six. Running for reps and paychecks.
Reward.
Stafford facing a four-man rush. Stafford in trouble. Ball knocked out. Loose ball. Seahawks have it at the 46-yard line. Jaron Reed. Lions hustling up. Stafford on the roll. Throws for the end zone, and it's intercepted by Coleman. Dixon. Dixon's going to run. Dixon looking for the first down, and he's got it.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, so back on to Seahawks in 2018, and this past Sunday the Seahawks travelled to the Motor City to face Matthew Stafford and the Detroit Lions, and it was quite a fun few hours, Adam.
Yeah, I had so much more fun than I thought I was going to, to the thorough annoyance to myself that I somehow bottled my own pick and changed to the Lions the last minute and was ruining it. Up until the end, really, because I did myself in.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of confident. I don't think I shared my prediction. So I was a lot more confident you and Rob were heading into this. I just kind of, maybe it was just a London high. But, I mean, I watched it after the fact. I watched it on condensed, so I maybe didn't pick up the flow as much as you do on that. I mean, 40-minute edition that you do, sitting through it for 3 hours. But as soon as David Moore catches the touchdown, it kind of seemed that the momentum was swung in the Seahawks' favour, and it never really seemed in doubt any other way. Was it like that watching it live?
Yeah, I think even before then, the turnover forced by Tedrick Thompson off Amir Abdullah running the ball out of the end zone. I think at that point, like, I had a real fist pump there and a real scream that Rosie got annoyed at me for shouting too loudly. Well, welcome to my world. I, at that point, I thought we got something here, and I think we'll do well. And yeah, we never looked back. It was just so flowingly brilliant from there on. And it was great to watch.
Yeah, and this week's on for those keeping track at home was 56 plays, but only 14 of them were completions, but 14 completions doesn't tell what was a banner day, really, for Russell Wilson, even at this stage of his career, wasn't it? 14 for 17, 248, three touchdowns, and 15 yards added on the ground. He was locked in to a pretty high, to a higher plane, wasn't he, on Sunday?
Yeah, it was one of those games that really stirred the joy that is Seahawk Twitter, because you had the people that were saying that we need to run, you know, lauding the running game, which was excellent. But for me, it was a game that highlighted vintage quarterback play backed up with a very good run game versus the other way around. I think, you know, having the ball in Wilson's hands was what made the majority of things tick, leading off, you know, some good runs that bashed up their defense a bit. But you know, I have to say that, and I said this on the Seahawkers podcast on Sunday evening, that I think we passed 18 times and ran 35 times or whatever. If we'd needed to close that gap and, you know, maybe run 30 times and pass 23 times or whatever, I think we could have scored more points, because every time we threw the ball, their secondary was so overmatched by our receivers that every time we threw it, it looked like something good was going to happen.
Yeah, I think there's a few on the highlight package NFL put up you hear in a few minutes. There's a few completions you hear on that, and the Fox commentator, I don't know who it was saying this is just too easy for the Seahawks. Every completion is there, and I mean, for a bit of a ticky-tacky call in the back of the end zone, this is a 35, maybe even a 40 point outing from the offense, which a month ago, which didn't look like he could get 40 yards on him.
Yeah, I mean, you've turned the ball over on the one-yard line, which I didn't hate going for that, as it happens. And you actually, you know, Wilson throws two touchdown passes in that series, one that Baldwin very uncharacteristically doesn't get his toes down to drag his second foot in, and the second one, that nonsense with Nick Vannett, who is shoved out the back of the end zone. It doesn't really make any sense why that you know, it is Vannett's fault.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've basically scored 35 points there. And, yeah, I mean, it really could have been more, I felt.
Yeah, Wilson was so good. He managed to get to become the first quarterback in franchise history to register a perfect 158.3 passer rating off the minimum 10 attempts. He was really that good, but it's also surprising that he hasn't hit that mark before when you think of some of the games he's had over his career in Seattle, isn't it?
Is it that he hasn't hit it before, or that I think there has to be a minimum number of pass attempts?
Well, I think it's minimum 10. He's passed that. Surely he's passed that.
Yeah, you would have thought so.
So I'm surprised when it was he come up with the only one.
Yeah, you would think that's happened before, because he has had some games like Philadelphia on the road a couple of years ago springs to mind as a game he was incredibly clean in. Yeah, I mean, he was just, it was just velvet. Yeah. It was one of those games that, when you wonder if Wilson's in the upper echelon of quarterbacks, he just sort of turned up to work, got his business done, and just you know, took the piss out of Detroit, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously behind him was a pretty functioning and pretty impressive running game. Obviously headed up yet again by Chris Carson, who's having a pretty impressive second year, or really the longest run he's had as the starting tailback for the Seahawks. 25 attempts on Sunday for 105 yards. Touchdown, which had a very, very familiar finish from a Seahawks running back. But again, and Mike Davis chipped in with 10 for 33 as well, but Chris Carson, there's some of the moves he makes in pretty tight spaces is possibly more impressive than rolling over to Detroit Lion linebackers on the one-yard line, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, that was great. He just said, get out of my way, I'm scoring, go away. Yeah. I loved that. But it's actually, you know, obviously it's impossible to separate any Seahawk running back that does well from Marshawn. But there's times where he jukes left and then manages to cut right and then sort of go back downhill, that reminds me very much of the way Lynch plays. Yeah. He's sort of got that. He's sort of like shakes his body almost, but is able to change direction and go between gaps. That really is great to watch. And you just have to hope the guy can stay healthy, because there's not a great record of running back staying healthy, especially the young ones. Yeah. So hopefully he can stay healthy, because the team obviously want to ride him as much as they can as well. You know, it may not be the dream offense that we want to watch. You can't say it's anything but effective, and they'd be daft to change now.
Yeah, I mean, he really does look the part. I think he's one of the highest rated running backs in the league per Pro Football Focus, which
he's ahead of Todd Gurley,
which is ridiculous. When Todd Gurley, I think, he's second favorite for the league MVP, which is just absolutely balmy. I think if coaches could win in the conversation ahead of any of the players he's got on that offense. But yeah, the Marshawn Lynch parallels, as you say, are going to be hard to overcome, but at the same time they are quite a bit of fun to work after what was just incredibly bad 2017. Outside of Mr. Carson, Tyler Lockett. I mean, we spent a bit of time in the offseason talking and debating whether he was worth the contract. It's Halloween, and he's tied his career high and has become one of three NFL wide receivers, along with Antonio Brown, Adam Thielen, to record at least one touchdown through six different games this season. I mean, the $10 million per year man is more than getting his due, and the talk of him having 2017 is the recovery year, and this will be the year we really see is really coming strongly into fruition, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird because he's actually only on for about 56 catches in the season for I think about 800 yards. Yeah. So it's quite weird to evaluate, because the touchdowns are obviously amazing and they're of huge importance. But there are Seahawks fans that were slating Jimmy Graham for only scoring touchdowns. Uh-huh. And you've got the same fans that are lauding Tyler Lockett. Now, I don't particularly mind at all. I think, you know, good on Lockett for scoring the touchdowns. But it strikes me as a tiny bit double standards that one's getting, you know, praised and the other one, it was, you know, ran out of town. Yeah. I had a very interesting discussion on the radio where they were saying, you know, for the next 2 years, would you rather have Tyler Lockett or David Moore? And it's obviously pretty early on in Moore's career to be making, you know, decisions and having discussions like that. But it was interesting because if you're paying a wide receiver $10 million a year, you kind of expect 1,000 yards as kind of a bare minimum. And it's a fairly reductive barometer, but it'll be interesting to see how his season ends up because, obviously the touchdowns are making it well worth it, but typically though, that doesn't always last. But 200 targets left the building last year. Yeah. So someone's got to take them. And although he's not taking that many more targets, obviously in the big areas, he is, you know, the target.
Yeah, man. On Jimmy Graham though, last year we mentioned to the fact that when he scored touchdowns, he wasn't getting many yards, and when he got all the yards, he wasn't getting many touchdowns. That's what Tyler Lockett is doing so far on Sunday: two targets, two catches, 34 yards, and a touchdown. But also one thing we'd let walk out the building last year is 16 touchdowns. So if someone's getting seven touchdowns, whatever Lockett's got through the first half of the season, that's half of the 16. Then you've got a functioning run game with Carson Davis chipping in probably half a dozen more. You've already, at half point, replaced those 16 touchdowns, which 3-4 months ago seemed unlikely and hard to spot where those touchdowns were coming from, as we said before the season started, Adam.
I think we had a conversation either with Nathan Ernst or Rob Staten about that exact question, yeah. You know, where are we going to get the touchdowns back from? And I think Rob was right. He said, you know, the running game will obviously chip in a bit more. And it will kind of, you won't need to be so heavily dependent on the passing game. And, it proves spot on. And, you know, it looks like we could, I don't know what the, you know, how we're ranking from a touchdown per game perspective now to what we were last year. But, it doesn't seem like we're shy on point scoring at this rate versus where we were last year.
Yeah, no. I think someone on Twitter, I can't remember who, made a point on Monday that this offense looks like it could score, as we said earlier, probably match what the Rams and Chiefs are doing to a certain extent week on week, but Pete Carroll just doesn't really go for, that really isn't his jive, is it? Do you think there's any weight to that? Kind of likes these.
No, I think you're looking at generational level offenses in Kansas, yeah, and Los Angeles. I mean, obviously that's helped by the fact that they probably have the two best offensive coaches in the league calling plays, and you know, a litany of very, very good targets. And it's not that we're miles off, but I don't think that we could necessarily, that those two teams are able to score basically points whenever they want at will on whichever team they want to score against. Yeah. I mean, they scored, Kansas got about 30 odd against Denver. Yeah. And I know it was the first game of the season, but we didn't exactly look like we were going to do that, did we?
No, that's very true. You've mentioned him as well, probably the breakout star of the Seahawks offense. He's currently, Adam, you basically were stopping just short of calling this guy a god on the Seahawks podcast. David Moore, 4 targets, 4 catches, 97 yards, and a juggling touchdown. He looks like what the Seahawks have missed since Sidney Rice started opening wing stops, Adam.
Yeah, I don't think we over-egg the pudding with David Moore. We just said he's probably a Hall of Famer because his number retired already.
Yeah, that's
which I think is pretty much, yeah, you know, I think that's a fairly realistic barometer. And, you know, we wouldn't want to put pressure on the guy. So I think just going Hall of Fame versus Jerry Rice, greatest receiver of all time, is probably a fair level of expectation.
It's a fair middle ground, I think.
It's funny with him because I don't know what you think about this, but he looks especially good to me because he's so far away from what we've had in the past 4 or 5 years. You know, it has all been smaller, nippier receivers that, you know, get open with routes versus just beating guys with their body. I mean, funnily enough, the first catch he made,
on the third down,
to me, it looked like a Brandon Marshall catch, which is funny because that's the player comp that I initially came to my mind. As soon as I saw that catch we made, I thought that looks just like Brandon Marshall, the way he kind of boxed the guy out, and won it at its highest point. So I think it's so much fun to see a player that we've not had for such a long time, that big bodied receiver. And yeah, he's just really fun to watch.
And also, I think with David Moore, he was a 7th round pick out of a very small school, the East Central Oklahoma State or something, the school was, which is D2.
There's no way that's a real name.
It's definitely East Central.
East Central?
East Central Oklahoma. I'm almost positive that's the name of the school. Yeah, but I think because at this point of his career, obviously, expectations for everyone apart from Adam Nathan are pretty low for a seventh round pick, given what we've got at the seventh round. But that's going to swing around if this carries on another couple of weeks, isn't it? And it's going to be where people firstly have to give him time if he just lay an egg 1 week, because obviously 17 passing attempts is not a lot to go around. But that is going to swing around. It's going to be interesting to how he lives up to raised expectations, isn't it, in the next few weeks, the rest of the season.
Yeah, he's going to be in that unfortunate position that if he has one more game like he had at the weekend, people are going to be expecting him to be AJ Green, Julio Jones, and give you that sort of, you know, wide receiver one, first round pick level production straight away. And realistically, that's not going to happen. He's going to have bad games. But the fact that we're able to add probably, well, without question, your number one running back, and I don't believe in a wide receiver one, because I think you need one tall guy and one small guy. I think, you know, you can have two wide receiver ones. But the fact that last year's seventh round pick seems to be giving us that as well as Chris Carson, quite incredible, really.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, a lot has been said about the last few years for the Seahawks draft. And yeah, there has been a lot of duds. I mean, after Sunday, there's a punter who has 13 yet less rushing yards than our third round pick from a few years ago. But yeah, there is a lot to be said. But if you start the draft, if you add Shaquille Griffin to last year's class, I can't really think of anyone else in last year's class before the seventh round. You think of like the last dozen or so draft picks the Seahawks have made. I mean, it's only 8 weeks for some of them, but they're starting to come around. Like it is, like I said to what we said to Rob last week, this has a 2012 feeling to it, and I'm not too sure why. I mean, no, this isn't the Legion of Boom, because that was just, as you say about other things, era-defining way of playing defense and the players at their best. I mean, if you go back and look at the players that the team cut in 2013 from that defensive backfield, it's insane how loaded that defense was. It isn't the same, but there is the similar feelings which the team and the players who were there back in 2012 seem to be picking up on it, don't they, as well?
Yeah, they 100% know that we were all doubting them going into the season, whether it's us versus us as fans, or, you know, the media saying, you know, first pick of the draft could go to Seattle because they're going to be so bad and team's got no offensive line, they've got no defense. They know this stuff because Luke Wilson said famously last year after they beat Philadelphia that the team were well aware of the spread going into the game, that they were underdogs. These guys exist with a chip on their shoulder, and, you know, it was tragic. Tragic's the wrong word. It was a shame to see so many faces of the franchise leave in the offseason, but they freshened it up, and you can only say at this point it's worked out okay. You know, I still don't think we're going to win the Super Bowl, despite texting three people on Sunday saying, see you in Atlanta.
I did that as well.
But ultimately, if we're building for next year, and we're making next year easier to navigate, then that's all we really wanted them to do this year anyway, wasn't it?
2012 was the groundworks with a playoff performance, which kind of, well, you know what Russell Wilson said the minute he got a field on Atlanta, it kind of laid the foundations for everything. I think if you spoke to anyone in that 2020, we spoke to Barker Robinson over the summer, and he said they thought they were going to win it that year, but they knew they were going to win it in 2013. I'm not saying the conversations at that point at VMAC currently, but if this carries on for another few weeks, it's with the players like David Moore, like Chris Carson, like the defensive players like Trey Flowers, Shaquille Griffin, Jerome Reed, Frank Clark, if they keep doing what they're doing, the similarities, like with Marshawn and Carson at running back, is going to be hard to ignore, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And we may need to pump the brakes tiniest bit, but ultimately, we 4 weeks ago, let's be honest, we were having a shite time of it, and we were bored out of our minds. We weren't enjoying watching the team. And as you said to me a couple of days ago, you know, 3 weeks ago we didn't like the team, and now the two of us are both online separately, desperately trying to look for flights to Seattle to get out for a game, even if we're there for four days. I mean, it's fun being a Seahawk fan, which I wasn't expecting this year, and it wasn't fun last year. It wasn't that much fun the 2 years before, running into the buzzsaws against Carolina and Atlanta in the playoffs. That wasn't that much fun either, because you knew really where it was going to end. At least now, I think I know where it might end, but I'm not entirely sure. And that's intriguing and it's fun. Yeah.
And basically, David Moore, what I've just said about David Moore and the expectations changing, that's basically what the 2018 Seahawks have as a whole, isn't it? That expectation was pretty low to begin with, and now it's starting to swing around, and it's how the team deal with that raised expectation.
Yeah, I think Carroll is pretty good at managing expectations and stuff like that. So More, if any group of players are going to stay... Yeah. level-headed, I would imagine it's this one. So I'm not that worried about that.
More for the fan base, which is quite rabid, shall we say.
Yeah, but it's part of being a fan in sport is losing your head. Yeah, it's great fun. And bring it on, because everyone's having a great time doing it.
Another guy who, on offense was Ed Dixon. And he said, please allow me to introduce himself. And for the Lions, he was... the devil sympathizer, wasn't he?
Well, he's an absolute lion slayer, isn't he? Because last year for Carolina, he absolutely tore them a new one. He was great. I mean, I think two catches only, but they were two of the most important catches that we had. That third down, the play action, I mean, that is just...
Yeah, that's like your favorite play if it's in the end zone, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the touchdown one's great, but the one that they can convert to the third down, that little sort of like a tight end wheel route almost... Yeah. I mean, you shouldn't get aroused by sports, but I was close. It was amazing.
I'd said to you, I think maybe Sunday night on Monday, that he just looks, I mean, we had Jimmy Graham for a few years, he just looked like an absolute phenom. Ed Dixon looks like a tight end. I'm not too sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing or a praise or not, but he just looks like, he looks like he should be playing tight end in the NFL, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's a fully grown man. He is... the tight end equivalent to what DJ Fluker is as a right guard. And whilst we kind of scoffed at some of the off-season draft picks they made, free agency pickups they made, they brought in real men.
Yeah.
Barkevious Mingo's and been another one that's proven that. And then you've got Fluker and Dixon who are just, they've just got a leadership to them without even, you look at them and you think you're a leader, and I can tell you're a leader of the team. And it's great and quite refreshing to have that, especially on offense.
Yeah, definitely. I was talking of DJ Fluker, that O-line yet again looked pretty impressive, didn't it? I mean, DJ Fluker is possibly the most popular free agent signing since Bennett and Avery in 2013. He's really made a difference, not just to, as we keep saying in the last few weeks, to the functionality of the O-line, but the guy on to the right in Jermaine Ifedi. I mean, this is a proper unit at last, isn't it?
Yeah, they're fantastic. I mean, we had Dwayne Brown pulling out to the right lead block for a running
back. He started at right tackle. He's basically tight end.
Yeah, it was crazy. But you've not seen like the left tackle pulling around outside the right to open up space for the running back. There's scheme stuff that's just completely different to anything that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years, which is really exciting to watch. And the creating clean pockets, the play action's obviously working really well for Wilson, and you only need to look at the productivity of someone like Carson and even Davis when he gets the ball to see that something's really working there, and it's great. It's so refreshing.
Yeah, it is, and it's encouraging. Like, everything is on the offensive side of the ball, but also on the defensive side of the ball. Kerryon Johnson was, as Rob said, really starting to set the NFL world alight until this past Sunday, when he had just 22 rushing yards, by far his lowest on his rookie season. I mean, that we kind of again scoffed and cast disparaging comments on the guys up front in that defensive line, but Jaron Reed is a monster, and Frank Clark is making it a lot richer, a lot more expensive for the team to extend him in the coming weeks and months. I mean, Those guys up top are really playing at a pretty high level, especially against the run, aren't they?
Yeah, the run especially. They're just shutting down running backs left, right and centre. I mean, even Todd Gurley, he's a goal line monster, but he didn't have that productive a day on the ground versus what he's been having previously. The pass rush is still something that worries me slightly. I don't think we're getting quite enough regular pressure on the quarterback, and Stafford is a tricky one to take on in that regard, but that's probably the one area that if you said it'd be nice to get a little bit more out of a group, it would probably be pass rush. But we said that going in into the season, and actually they're probably outperforming what we expected. You've had sacks in consecutive weeks by someone like Shamar Stephen, who I'm still not even sure is a real person. Puna Ford's been really good. You've got Naz Jones to come back, who hopefully he does come back, as opposed to, I actually thought he was going to be traded this week. But the pass rush is probably what you want to get a little bit more from. But players like Reed and Clark are, really just been fantastic all year. Yeah,
definitely. I mean, Jaron Reed, I've got a jersey on my way with him on the back. He is just, he was a good run stuffer as he is for the Seahawks. He's doing it somewhat under the radar, but his pass rush is slowly getting there. Obviously, another sack on Sunday, and Stephen and Frank Clark had sacks on Sunday. But then you look behind them, and there's a familiar face alongside Bobby at linebacker. And I mean, this defense with KJ White, there's still probably some doubts on his long term future in Seattle, but it was good to see him back, and he barely skipped a beat, did he, in his 2 month absence.
The best thing I can say about him is that I kind of didn't notice he was there. Like, he just sort of went about his business, made his tackles, disrupted where he wanted to. I mean, Bobby was kind of the guy that made the more showreel plays. I mean, he
14 just tackles on got, Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, Golden Tate did not have a nice time on Sunday afternoon because of Bobby Wagner. And KJ was kind of just there, just doing KJ Wright things and keeping everything ticking over. I didn't notice he was there, but I mean that as the best compliment I probably can. Yeah.
And on the secondary, again, being a lot of attention, obviously, paid to Shaquille Griffin. I mean, you talk about not mentioning KJ Wright. I mean, Griffin is getting near to Sherman, isn't he? He's barely see him on the screen. You see his brother, you see his twin more often with all the stuff he's doing for people with the same ailment that he has. He's getting to that. And obviously, Trey Flowers is probably the David Moore of the defense, of how he's emerged. And he just looks like he's been playing the cornerback position in Seattle for a decade or so. Then there's the guy who, as you said, is the most clutch player ever, Adam, in Justin Coleman.
He is. I mean, every time you need a big play, Justin Coleman seems to step up and make one for you. Yeah, I think that Griffin was getting some heat on social media about regressing, which I thought was a little bit weird because I think he's been excellent all season, to be honest. The secondary, they have a few problems. There's a couple of breakdowns of communication. The safeties didn't cover themselves in glory on either of the Lions' touchdowns on Sunday. But that's to be expected considering it's one second-round player, McDougal obviously a bit more experienced, but then two rookies really in there because Thompson barely touched the ball last year. So I think overall you can't really ask a lot more, especially as the fact that the pass rush isn't that dominant to, you're not getting so many sacks that the quarterback's got to just throw it up at them, which is where, a lot of the LOB feasted in the past. So I don't think you can ask an awful lot more of what you're getting from them.
I didn't see it because I didn't watch it live, but I can imagine that Tedrick Thompson took a lot of flack for how he played the first line touchdown to Marvin Jones. It was just one misstep and that was it. That's the margin of error. But I think I said to you that the way he bounced back from that, he flashed across the screen a couple of times, could have got at least one interception, probably should have had two on Sunday. And obviously he made the play and he forced a fumble on the kick return on Amir Abdullah, I think it was. So, someone like that, you have to have a short-term memory, and obviously he doesn't have Earl around. Cam is still loitering on the sidelines every week, obviously being a mentor to the young pups back there. But to see that bounce back from what could have been a big-time misstep on the first touchdown, it's encouraging, isn't it?
100%. And, the guy's probably... It's what, his second ever start, maybe third ever start. Yeah. So it's almost unrealistic to expect miracles from the guy. And I don't really think you can ask an awful lot more from him right now.
So also the one other thing is probably the play that sealed it has got a lot of attention from different areas. Michael Dixon's 9-yard dash for the first down pylon and then got lit up with a play where he was meant to take 10 or so seconds off the clock and take a safety. I mean, this punter is making it hard for people not to notice him, isn't he? I mean, another game where he nearly had a 50-yard punt average, had two down inside the 20, and then sealed the game with a rush, Adam.
Yeah, slightly concerning when he said he didn't actually know how many yards he had to pick up to get the first down. I didn't love that. But no, he was, you know, did a great job kicking, and that was just a fun play, and it's really nice to see, you know, for us to ice a game with a weird thing as opposed to having it done to us, as almost always happens in the past.
Another Sunday where Johnny Hecker broke a team's opposing team's heart as well with a fake punt throw, which he did to the Packers on Sunday. But obviously on that Michael Dixon play, if anyone is on Twitter or Instagram or anywhere, former Colts punter Pat McAfee is on Sundays and Saturdays especially. It's quite a funny follow. If you want to hear a breakdown like no other breakdown, here is what how Pat McAfee represented the brand and broke down the 9-yard run from our Aussie punter.
Detroit can't help it. They start to get some momentum. They got the Seahawks backed up. And what does the Aussie bomber Michael Dixon do? You see, let's break this down real quick, all right? So you got 8 men in the box because the gunners are singled out here. You see, single, single. So you got 8 people in here. They all appear as if they're going for the block. Because if you get a block right here, you steal some points. Good field position, put pressure on Dixon. Backed up, they're on the 3-yard line, it appears. Normal box is 14 yards. Simple math there, 3 plus the 10-yard end zone. It's a short box. Very easy to potentially block this here. What does Dixon do? Gets the snap, very comfortable, rolls to his right. I think he was supposed to just take off some time here. Get a safety. No big deal. Give the Lions 2 more points and then punt from the 20. Flip the field, 2 minutes left, 1 timeout, down 12. They got no chance of coming back. But Michael Dixon, being a freak athlete, sees space and opportunity. I'm from Australia, he says. Let me pick up the first down and end the game myself. The whole team's jacked up. Pete Carroll's chewing the shit out of his gum. Way to go. That's an audible. That is an Omaha. That is an apple for Michael Dixon. You see, I think he's just supposed to like kind of scoot around, buy some time. No, I got nothing but space. Let me turn it upfield and get the first down. What a play by Michael Dixon for the brand. Handsome cuzzy from Australia over in Seattle.
Yeah, so to wrap up quickly the Detroit game, one to praise on offense or and defense or overall, Adam?
I will go Ed Dixon for his first start to make 2 flashy plays like that. And I will go on defense. Difficult to keep Frank Clark out of the headlines, isn't it? I thought he was exceptional again.
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard not to go anywhere but David Moore. Also, maybe the wide receiver room for their choreography on the celebrations where they reenacted a baseball player being beaned by a pitch and then Baldwin running at Lockett and Lockett swinging a fake punch. And I think Russell Wilson got involved kind of like an awkward uncle, didn't he, at the end of it and kind of sung.
Didn't really know what he was supposed to do there, Wilson, did he?
But apparently there's a better one coming per the talk from, I think, there's Baldwin and Lockett in the locker room after the game. But now we are on to those powder blue LA Chargers.
Leon Washington, the return man for Seattle. And Washington's got a lane. Leon Washington turning on the speed. Washington. He's gone. Touchdown, Seahawks. 101 yards.
Yep. So as the Seahawks finally have a home game, it's been about a month or so since the last time the Seahawks played at CenturyLink Field. Obviously, they lost a tight one to the only remaining unbeaten team in the NFL in the LA Rams. But this is going to be a pretty tough out against a QB who is at the height of his veteran quarterbacking powers.
Yeah, he's probably up there as an MVP candidate right now. And it's funny because actually people have been saying that the Seahawks have no real quality wins, which is probably fair. But the Chargers don't really have any quality wins either. I mean, I did sort of a brief power rankings, have the Chargers in my top 5 teams in the NFL right now. And I think that's general consensus amongst most commentators that they are, you know, the real deal, especially when Joe Bosa comes back. But if the Seahawks have shown anything, it's that they can be a match for anyone with that Rams game. So whilst I think the Chargers probably are the better team overall, I'd like to think that playing in Seattle, we're on a high, we're playing well. It should hopefully swing, not the balance in our favor, but certainly close that gap of ability, and I think we've got a heck of a chance to win.
Rivers and the Chargers offense are the eighth for in points offense and sixth in yards, a total offense on the 2018 season. They are on a four-game winning streak after wins against the Niners, the Raiders, the Browns, and then 2 weeks ago at Wembley against the Titans. I mean, with the Chiefs and the Chargers, this is as big a game for them as it is for us, obviously, as it is most weeks in the NFL, but a lot is going to pin on the health of their all-pro Pro Bowl running back, Melvin Gordon, isn't it, who I think mispracticed again today after missing the Titans game in London.
Certainly going to help, but I think with the ability we've had stopping the run, if you said to me, who would you rather have injured, Phillip Rivers or Melvin Gordon, I would choose Rivers, seven times out of seven and twice on Sunday. Rivers is the guy who makes everything tick with them. He is an absolutely phenomenal quarterback. He's unfortunate that his legacy might be tarnished by the fact that he's never going to play in a Super Bowl, maybe, unless they make it this year or maybe next year. And I'm still fairly scarred by the way he tore us to pieces with Chinese cut paper cuts, or whatever it's called, Chinese water treatment, in San Diego 3 or 4 years ago, when they just dink and dunked their way to beating us. So I think Gordon, if he's out, everyone will be very happy, but Rivers is the one that it makes it all tick for me.
The offense outside of Rivers, though, is a lot of similarities to how the Seahawks line up. They have the speedy guy who can get downfield in Tyrell Williams. They have the possession guy like Doug Baldwin and Keenan Allen. And then they also have the guy who's proven a lot this year in his second year in the league. And Mike Williams, obviously, who was drafted six rounds before David Moore. And then obviously they've got the old man, old father time at tight end, Antonio Gates, who's just one of the goats at the position, isn't he? I mean, they do kind of line up a bit similarly to our Seahawks, don't they?
Yeah, they're just a very well-built team. They've got everything that you'd want. They're always unfortunate with injuries. Hunza Henry would have been a real asset to the offense this year, but he's obviously out, I think, done for the year. They're just going to be hard to stop. And the way in which Rivers can just lead a team downfield. And dink and dunk, as much as we have defended very well in general season, we've not been hugely successful at stopping long drives from happening, or pass breakups isn't, I'm not basing this on any facts, but I kind of feel that if a pass isn't completed on us, it's more likely been a bad throw versus a pass breakup by one of our guys. And I think the slight worry for me is that he could just dink and dunk his way to up and down the field all over us on Sunday. Don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, like you, I can't. The image of him just throwing 4 or 5 yards and then getting all the yak down in San Diego lingers. And I think if anyone's going to come into, I mean, we saw, what was it, 3 years ago with what Tony Romo did with that team. And that Dallas team has a lot of the same aspects to what this Chargers team does as well. And it just kind of has that feel that we kind of had going into that game, where the veteran presence against what is a pretty young defense, obviously with minus outside of a few players, this is going to be a real test for those young, inexperienced guys, especially in the back seven, isn't it?
It's going to be a huge test. It'd be, along with the Rams game, their hardest test, and it'll be a different test to that Rams game, so it should be quite fun to see how they do. And if we're building for next year, then it's always handy to have challenges like this and see how they come through.
Definitely. And also the defensive side for the Chargers, they've got their big, shiny first-round pick from this past year in the center field, Derwin James, who is having a pretty impressive rookie year. And then obviously up front, they've got Joey Bosa, possibly, who's missed every single game after I picked him, before I picked a running back in fantasy football this year. Cheers, Fat Joey. And then opposite him, I've got Melvin Ingram. The defense is pretty stout. I mean, they don't give up, obviously, as we said, we haven't really faced the power, give up all the yards in the world to the Chiefs and back in week one. This defense has some threatening aspects to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, Derwin James is a proper playmaker. He was, unfortunately, Well, it would be interesting to see if he wasn't taken at 17 by the Chargers, if we would have taken him at 18, the pick after it in the draft. I don't think we didn't trade down until our pick, did we? So, yeah, he would have been a fantastic guy to have because he is just an out-and-out playmaker and just a complete ball hawk. So I'm looking forward to watching him and seeing how Wilson is able to use, you know, misdirection and how they're able to keep him away from the ball, because the last thing you want is for him to come crashing down. And you know, he's making sacks, he's intercepting passes. He's everywhere. So he's going to be fun to watch for a long time. And yeah, I just hope we're able to keep the ball away from him long enough to move up and down the field.
I think on Sunday in Detroit, the team held the ball for like 34 minutes, I think it was, which is was a big part, as well as everything else happening Sunday. So you'd hope that the Seahawks can reverse what happened 4 years ago in San Diego and to give them a taste, a defensive taste of what they gave us 4 years ago. But this for the Seahawks, as we said, it says an awful lot if they sit there on Monday morning with a W in the wing in the column, doesn't it?
I think two and two has got to be the target for the next four games, and it's not going to be easy because I would say that they are probably fairly strong underdogs in two games, certainly the two road games in Los Angeles and in Carolina. And I think you could very easily put a case together that we're, you know, strongish underdogs in this game as well. Obviously, we're coming off the back of four or five really good wins and performances in the loss to Los Angeles as well. But I think it's going to be a tricky game, and we'll know a lot more about ourselves come midnight on Sunday night.
I agree. It's going to be quite a tough game. Also, it could be quite a fun one to watch on Sunday night. It may take more attention than people may have expected a few weeks ago. Prediction then, Adam?
Oh, good one. I think we might... I don't know about that. I was just about to say 27-25 to the Chargers. I don't even know if that's possible. But I actually... No, I think we might do it. I'm going to go 27-24, Seattle.
Ooh. I think I have put a prediction somewhere, but yeah, I think we're going to win. I think we're going to break the 30-point barrier on Sunday. We're just doing what we saw on Sunday, repeating that back at home. The home field advantage is going to count, as it does for most, especially in Vegas, for 3 points. I think that could be a big swing. I just think the defense is going to have that one play which they had on Sunday with Justin Coleman. I think that's going to happen again, and I think especially if Joey Bosa misses out, I think Russell Wilson could have, as he says, time to cook steaks in that backfield. I think that will hopefully be enough, and the Seahawks could be sitting pretty at 5-3 come Monday morning, which is just madness when you think of the whole aura and feeling around this team when it ended Monday night in Chicago 6 weeks ago.
It would be insane. It would be completely unheard of. It would be absolutely fantastic if that does end up happening.
There's going to be some roundabout turns coming across the Seahawks fandom, Twitter and Facebook and everything in the next few weeks if this carries on. Now, this pod has changed as it's now in its third year over that time. We lost a voice, obviously, with Ross leaving in the summer. And now, unfortunately, earlier this week, another stalwart has gone. For now, we hope.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization. I don't even recall that situation that you're speaking to. So I don't want to say something and be wrong. So that one didn't hit my head.
There's no question that we drafted Baker for a reason. And I think he's the future of this franchise. But Tyrod Taylor has demonstrated all offseason what he needed to show us and show me and the staff to be the starter.
I don't think anybody else could have did this job. I've said that before. I don't think a lot of people could have did this job. So
within the last 15 minutes, the Browns have fired their head coach, Hugh Jackson. Just 3 wins over the last 2.5 seasons and a public power struggle with his offensive coordinator, Todd Haley. So
yeah, it was a sad, predictable, and let's be honest, long overdue firing on Monday in Cleveland, Ohio, as Hugh Jackson was fired by the Cleveland Browns. We now have about 7 minutes to fill in every weekly podcast, don't we?
Yeah, it's very sad news for the podcast. It's not sad news for the Cleveland Browns because he was the all-time worst. I mean, he actually was the second all-time worst head coach by record. So I'm not even, you know, as a man who enjoys a bit of hyperbole, I'm actually not going that over the top on this one. He is the second all-time worst head coach. So yeah, he has been just abysmal and really should have been sacked in the off season. For some reason he wasn't. But he's gone now. And, I mean, the bin will always be a place where he can call home whenever he'd like to. But he will be sorely missed, not really, but kind of from a banter point of view.
Yeah, and I think someone on Twitter, Benjamin Albright, who covers the Broncos most closely, said that he's had texts from players and staff in the Cleveland Browns organization who compared Hugh Jackson more than once to Michael Scott. And if you watch the clip of him with his staff and Todd Haley's reaction, he's amazing, from Hard Knocks, where he just kind of said, "I've been in that seat, but now I'm here," kind of thing. It is... He really was the George Foreman Grillburn of all NFL coaches. So it is on that. It's probably time that we do dive back in and do another Get in the Bin this week.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly's an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
Yeah, get in the bin. Mine was going to be pretty straightforward until about 10 minutes before we started recording, as Maryland fired their head coach, DJ Durkin, after reinstating him after all the nonsense happened there. His all conditioning played a part, allegedly played a part in the untimely death of one of their offensive linemen in the summer, but he's been fired as of 20 minutes before recording. So, Adam, while I think of a new one, anyone for you?
I kind of want to do like a reverse bin, if I may, because although it kind of does put someone in the bin in their own right, Kelvin Benjamin, his career is not really going anywhere. And for a guy that looked so good initially, he doesn't seem to be taking care of himself at all. It didn't work out in Carolina. It's not really working in Buffalo. But Boogie, who is the guy that's the third guy in the booth on Monday Night Football, which is a horrifically produced program at the minute. The commentators are both dreadful, so they can get in the bin, including Jason Witten. But Boogie, about Kelvin Benjamin and his not the best footballing shape at the minute, said on Monday night, he looks a Popeye's biscuit short of being a tight end.
That was pretty good.
Which I really did think was an outstanding comment. So Boogie might have a get out of the bin free card forever. If we ever put him in the bin, he can use this card to keep him out of it. I'm stealing a bit there from Damashek. That can make a get out of the bin free card. Kelvin Benjamin inadvertently just, and he's got a bit of an annoying face, Benjamin. So yeah, I think he's going to have to go in.
He's verging on Jamarcus Russell territory with how he's just, he thinks of himself and is presenting himself and looks. He is definitely verging on that. Yeah, so I'm all for that. But also, for me, I think I'm going to stick in that town. There is a case for him. He can't do a lot when the team is trotting out Derek Anderson and Nathan Peterman in back-to-back weeks. I think I think someone tweeted when they announced that Peterman was starting this Sunday against the Bears, I think they're playing, that the NFL should just settle up with Colin Kaepernick now, because there is no more evidence for the defense, for the prosecution, is there, on this now? I mean, it's just an absolute farce. I mean, with any functioning quarterback on that field on Monday, they probably beat the New England Patriots. That defense could not do any more. I think the lowest passer rating given up by 1 and 2 on passer rating given up by NFL defenses over the last month, the Browns and the Bills. And they have like two, three combined wins between them in that time. And a lot of that, obviously, a lot of the Cleveland stuff is Hugh Jackson, we spoke about. But the only reason Buffalo aren't winning games is because they don't have a quarterback. And Eric Reed mentioned, more than once on Sunday when talking about why he had a problem with Malcolm Jenkins 10 days ago. And Terry Pegula's name cropped up two or three times as to the guy who was a driving force about getting Malcolm Jenkins on the NFL's side. Terry Pegula owns every sports team in Buffalo, so that is quite an interesting correlation when you think of the quarterback position and the mere absence of CK7, Adam.
Yeah, it's a complete farce with Kaepernick at the minute. And if Kaepernick goes to court, you just have to, you know, send a list of some of the starting quarterbacks going out there and say, thanks very much, I'm off. Because, you know, Brock Osweiler, let's not forget that he's a complete disaster. There's so many of them that are just awful. But let's be honest, we know it's nothing to do with the ability and it's blackballing. And hopefully Kaepernick can get a resolution to this case because it is really ridiculous.
Yeah, it truly, truly is. Yeah, the Buffalo Bills organization can get in the bin for their complete haphazardness way of... I mean, they got rid of Tyra Taylor for another reason. He didn't last long with Baker Mayfield, but Tyra Taylor was a pretty... He's better than what they've got now, surely.
100%.
Absolute nonsense. Elsewhere, the NFL, obviously, 24 hours ago or so, 30 hours ago probably at this point, the trade deadline in the NFL passed. No Seahawks moves in or out, which is quite remarkable given what we spent most of the summer dealing with. But there was a few moves. Golden Tate, after probably getting bashed and bruised by KJ and Bobby, is now in Philly with Black Santa. Adam, I mean, that's a strange move for Detroit, but a pretty good one, a pretty cool one for Golden and the Eagles, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't really know what Detroit are doing there. I kind of thought they were in a bit of a win-now mode, but obviously they're not, because this is a pretty strange decision. I don't know how much cap space they're shedding with this. And, you know, third-round draft pick, nothing to be sniffed at. So I'm sure they're very happy to have that. But it doesn't... Yeah, it strikes me as a strange move on their part. But ultimately, the whole wide receiver market is very strange, given Amari Cooper went for a first round and Golden Tate gone for a third when they've got similar numbers of games left on their contracts. And I would suggest that if you had to give me one for the rest of the season, I would go with Golden Tate ahead of Amari Cooper without even a second thought.
I tweeted one of the guys I know who's an Eagles fan from my Disney League, say he got one of my favourite ever Seahawks. Golden Tate, it's just a shame he didn't have the need, really, I guess, but the firepower to go and get him as well, because that would have been really cool to see him with this wide receiver group. Elsewhere, are the Packers waving the flag, Adam, and is Mick McCarthy probably would do more good for his quarterback than Mike McCarthy's doing at the minute. He's on a pretty hot seat in Green Bay, isn't he?
Well, you'd think he is. But you'd have thought he'd been on a hot seat for quite a while, considering the fact that he's not really taken maybe the best quarterback of all time anywhere near a Super Bowl for a number of years. It's quite strange. They've got rid of Ha Clinton Dix and Ty Montgomery. Is just the two of them, or have they got rid of other players as well?
But I think, as someone tweeted, I think after Sunday, I think the Packers would have give up Ty Montgomery for NBA Live 1995 after Sunday. So I think they could have took anything. I think we could have had him for just general meets, I think, if other people had walked off with it. I mean, they're wasting possibly someone who should be going down as one of the best quarterbacks ever, and they just seem to be wasted it and no real risk to change it, really, do they?
Yeah, I think they're a team fairly in need of a reset, probably in the coaching environment. Tom Brady loves throwing shade at Mike McCarthy. He said it again this year. He said in his press conference today that Aaron Rodgers is much more talented than him. And if he played in Bill Belichick's offense, he'd have 7,000 yards. So he's trying to make out that Rodgers is a great guy, but actually he's just skewering Mike McCarthy. That. Mike McCarthy's obviously very much in Tom Brady's proverbial bin. So it's nice to know that he plays along as well.
We'll have to get bingo cards out to Foxborough at some point. I'm sure Tom will come on the podcast with us one day,
so we can raise it again.
Plenty of time. We'll just get a few white wine spritzers down Giselle, and she can just start ranting and raving about Wes Welker again. let's move on to week 9. What a Thursday night we have this week. The Raiders against the Niners. What a battle that's going to be.
yes.
Yeah, as we enter the week 9, the Seahawks play in their 8th game. We are basically at the halfway point of the season, so we are going to fire off via Adam, if you are prepared.
I am.
You've managed to actually do some work before a podcast this week, and you've put together some power rankings and tiers for the 32 NFL teams in 2018 season. So, Adam, the floor is yours, sir.
So it's a bit of fun. So I ended up ranking all the teams, and I've not ranked them within the tiers, but I've just put them into six different tiers of team. So play along at home if anyone fancies writing their own up and sending it in. I'd be more than happy to compare and contrast. But so in tier one, I've got five teams. I've got the Rams, the Saints, the Chiefs, the Chargers, and the Patriots. So I think what I'm saying there is my tier one is my Super Bowl favorites.
Okay, as you said with Chargers, Chargers is probably the only one you can probably debate. But the other guys I got, you mentioned Tom Gurley, MVP candidate. I mean, Patrick Mahomes is the greatest to ever do it. The Rams are offense, which is just ridiculous and almost impossible to stop. Saints, Drew Brees is just piling up numbers. It was a properly impressive win on Sunday night against Minnesota, which is a team which is kind of struggling for a foothold on the season. So yeah, no real disagreement with those five. Probably obviously the one who's going to sneak in is the Chargers, and I think a lot that could either be consolidated or seem to be a bit silly come Sunday night.
I think we'll know a lot about that by the time Sunday comes round. So tier two, I've got seven teams. Again, these are not ranked within the tiers. These are just the teams that I've got. So the second tier, so I guess you're saying hopeful of the playoffs and see where they go from there. And if they get in the playoffs, they've got half a chance. So I've got the Seahawks, the Packers still, because I think Aaron Rodgers is good enough to warrant that. The Vikings, although I'm not convinced, but I think they've probably got enough good credit in the bank to deserve that. The Panthers, the Eagles, the Steelers, and the Houston Texans.
I'll probably put the Ravens in that as well. Did you put the Ravens in that?
I didn't. They're in my next tier just because I can't take them seriously given Flacco.
Yeah, I noticed that, but that defense is proper. That defense is a proper defense.
But defenses don't really win championships anymore.
No, but
for me,
it's in a division. The teams they're going to be playing down the stretch, especially in that division with the Bengals and the Steelers. They could have Le'Veon Bell, probably not. It looks like at this point, I think that defense is going to keep them in games. I think, and that's going to play a lot for them to be in that playoff consideration. So I think they probably would just sneak into that.
I didn't feel that I could put them in the same tier as the Panthers after the Panthers eviscerated last week.
At the same point, I don't think the Seahawks probably belong in that part either for the same reason, I think.
We're having fun though, Stu. We're having a bit of fun.
We've got to disagree at some point on this podcast. So like 77 episodes in, we probably should find a...
Yeah. That is true. Yeah, so maybe I'm a bit of hometown bias putting the Seahawks in there. Tier 3, I've got the Falcons, the Redskins, the Lions, the Bengals, the Ravens, the Jags, so I think can just about still sneak back in, and the Colts, so I think are on a sneakily good run that deserves a bit of recognition.
Yeah, Frank Reich is the next bright thing in the NFL coaching circle. He is doing that running game. We've raving about how the Seahawks running game looked with Dwayne Brown at tight end and George Fant running routes at some point. On Sunday, that running game of Marlon Mack and Naheem Hines and the other guy. I mean, Andrew Luck looks back to what Andrew Luck looked like 2.5-3 years ago. I mean, that's a proper team. They could be someone who has a post-Thanksgiving run in there.
Yeah, so that's, I guess, the third tier is no reason they can't make the playoffs if they put a run together. So I think that's why I've put those sides in there. Tier four, I guess, is unlikely to make the playoffs. I've only got four teams there. I've got the Cowboys, the Bears, the Titans, who maybe are one tier too high, but I think Vrabel's doing a good job there, and the Broncos.
I think the Bears deserve to be the higher one. I think Trubisky's having a really good year. Matt Nagy's doing a hell of a lot for him and his NFL career.
Yeah, you might be right.
Anthony Miller, he's having a properly impressive rookie season. They look pretty good on Sunday.
Yeah, no, you might be right. I feel like Trubisky's, I need to see a little bit more from him before I start really taking him seriously. He's still striking as a bit of a gadget quarterback, which he isn't. That's disrespectful, but there's still, yeah, he's not a Mahomes or a Watson or anything like that yet, and I want to see a couple more games of him as he has been in the last couple of weeks.
I think he is because of who his coach is and what his coach is doing and what he's putting in situations. Mitch Trubisky or Jared Goff?
You probably have to say Goff on the balance of what's on the tape right now. But I'd rather have McVay. If you were saying I'm going to have McVay, I'd probably rather go Trubisky.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair enough. Anyway.
So then tier five, you're looking at teams that are shite, but maybe not an absolute dumpster fire. And, you know, with a bit more luck, better coach, they might have half a chance of being decent again, or less injuries enough. So that's the Jets, the Dolphins, and the Browns.
Yeah, that seems about right. Well, because
I don't think they deserve to be seen as awful teams, because, I mean, the Browns could have easily started 3-0 if they started Baker Mayfield. The Jets, I think, with Darnold, have got something good going, but they've just got so little, you know, real quality there outside of him. And the Dolphins have been unlucky that Tannehill can just never stay healthy.
Yeah, I quite like the Dolphins. I think they're going to be an annoying team, but I do think they could be playing for... have games later in the schedule where they're actually playing for something as you turn into December. I think nothing's changed for that. I think the running game is going to be a lot for them. The pass rush is doing more than probably should. And yeah, a lot of it depends on what how's happening with Tannehill, because you can't really go much longer with 8 foot Brock at quarterback.
So that leaves me with tier six, which are just the lowest of the low. And I've got the Niners, the Cardinals, the Giants, who are just an absolute disgrace. The Bucks, who I did this when Jameis Winston was still the quarterback, and maybe with Fitzmagic, they deserve to be one up because they've got decent talent around them. But he pisses me off so much, Winston, that I just put them in this tier six straight away. The Raiders and the Bills.
Yeah, that's probably about right. The Buccaneers could be the one who fluctuates, but Fitzpatrick can put fire in the jars one week and throw fire in the interceptions the next. The Cardinals. What is how? Yeah, that game on Sunday was like a tennis score at one point.
It was a tough watch.
It wasn't great. And Josh Rosen is doing the best he can. Poor Larry Fitzgerald and David Johnson, though.
Yeah, there was no discernible difference having changed the defensive coordinator. There was still nothing particularly flashy about what they were doing. It was a tough watch.
If you want to let us know your thoughts, or on the Facebook page, the Passion Podcast, on Twitter at Seahawkers UK, or on the Facebook group, you can. We're always up for a bit of derision, which may come, but don't think much will. And then just we did ask you yesterday for a few questions. A few of them did come in. Sean asked what's next for the bin, and as Adam, you responded, a truly dark time. Yep, we're gonna see what happens, see who the next Hugh is to emerge from the shadows. Mark Woodcock asked, what did we think of the Aussie sweep? Should Dixon have just taken the safety? Nah, come on, it's a bit of fun. Like, we didn't expect much fun, and we get a fun from a fifth round Aussie punter who's punting 50 yards every time. And all the stories from it, honestly. I think Brian Nem has a hot blog. He had big Dixon energy, which is a pretty cool way of putting it. And then Gordon Wright asks a couple of questions. I need to find the other one. Pay Fluka, Sweezy, what do we risk on the roster if we do? I don't think they pay JR Sweezy. I think they try and hope that he gets a pretty hefty sum from somewhere else again and take the compo pick if we can the year after. But I don't think there's any shadow of doubt they're paying DJ Fluka, is there, Adam?
No, especially with a large amount of cap space going into next season. You forget that 25% of our cap right now is being spent on players that are not on the roster. And I think, Cam Chancellor aside, that stops next year. So there is a lot more room to manoeuvre in free agency. And I think they can pretty much bring back any guys they want to. One of whom to look out for over there is Frank Clark, who, as far as it seems, is 100%. Going to hit free agency.
He's going to get 16, 17 million plus per year.
Well, he's going to get franchise tagged. That's what's going to happen.
Okay. Something to watch.
I think.
Yeah, but one reason I think they pay Sweezy is they've put a lot of draft capital, second round pick, on Ethan Posich, and while he wasn't great, we haven't seen him in this makeup for their line, and with Solari's coaching. So I think they still believe in him. Obviously, Joe Hunt's managed to linger for 3 or 4 years. I think Posich's presence on that left side will say a lot for where Sweezy, what they'd be willing to pay Sweezy. I think they would be okay with letting him walk, especially after who they let walk last off season. Gordon also wants to know about our college football thoughts on who are our top four. It's Alabama, Clemson, and everyone else, I think. The Clemson D-line, as Rob said last week, is just unbelievable. Those guys are going to go top 40, all four of them. They're just ridiculously talented up there. And then obviously you've got Tua for Alabama. And outside of that, you've got Kyler Murray for Oklahoma. I think they're on the outside looking in. And that LSU defense with Ed Orgeron is flying around. So I'd hope that would be the four. Notre Dame is... Rob said last week, they're going to be found out sooner or later. So I think it'll be LSU, Oklahoma, Clemson, and Alabama. But it's going to be hard to stop Bama.
I mean, Bama are going to rinse it, I would imagine, without any shadow of a doubt. To be honest, bit of a shame, bit of a damp squib, but that's just the way it's going to be, isn't it? They're incredible. Again, I don't. They're just an unbelievable dynasty, and they keep churning it out. But I am very much looking forward to watching the game on Sunday against LSU, because I think that could be an absolute cracker.
Well, as Rob said last week, they are without their star top 15 linebacker who got chucked out for a bonkers targeting call 2 weeks ago. And also, obviously, closer to our thoughts, are the Huskies, Adam.
They stink.
Down the days to Jacob Eason.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough watch. I watched, stayed up and watched them on Saturday night, took the advantage, clearly not an advantage, to be honest, of the extra hour sleep I was going to get with the clocks going back, and I kind of wish I'd taken the extra hour sleep in bed, to be honest, because it was bilge. Yeah, it was
great. I mean, the California didn't score a touchdown, did they, and still win?
No.
So it just says all you need to go. They're now...
Well, did score a defensive touchdown.
And they're no longer ranked, while the Cougars across state in Pullman are number 8 above Ohio State, which is probably quite something for Coug fans in Pullman and all over Washington State. And obviously there's a few over here as well. But yeah, moving on with the chapter stuff. Next Sunday, even in Newark, in Nottinghamshire, Kieran Byrne is hosting a meet at a pub in the town for a meet up to watch the Rams game next Sunday night. So it's on the Facebook page. I think it's on the events tab on the Facebook page at UK Seattle Seahawks fans. And obviously, a few weeks later, the Gordons up in Scotland, up in Glasgow, I think they're nearing a venue. It's somewhere in the heart of the city. They're getting together for the 49ers game on the 16th of December. And then Birmingham on Super Bowl night at O'Neill's on Broad Street in the heart of Birmingham. We've got about 15 spaces before we start having to beg and plead with the guys who own the pub, run the pub, who have been more than willing and more than helpful over the first few weeks. So a massive thanks to everyone who's declared an interest in coming down. And apparently, Adam, you're going to venture north of the M25 for that.
Well, I feel, add a bit of gravitas and class to the event. I may join you, unless I'm obviously in Atlanta, which is equally as possible.
Me and James, I've considered what the hell we're going to do if that happens, and we're not too sure. The room with the bigger capacity is undergoing renovation in January, so yeah, that could be interesting. Yes, so if you want to follow the podcast, you can on Podbean, thepedestrianpodcast.podbean.com. As I said, the Facebook group, UK Seattle Seahawks fans, on Twitter, Seahawkers UK. On Facebook, also the podcast, The Pedestrian Podcast, ukseahawkers.com. The membership for 2019 opens up, I believe, on Monday. I'm not too sure, but it's coming very soon. All the stuff and all the details on that will be announced by Sean and Cedric and everyone else on the committee in the next week or so. The Helitzky stuff, Helitzky Hope, clothes, hoodies, and wristbands are still available. There will be some stuff sent up to Glasgow for those guys to sell if you go into that meet in a few weeks. The money raised so far is pretty cool to see written in black and white. And then on Twitter, myself is Stu_Court and Adam is at Adam D. Nathan. Anything else you want to cover, Adam?
No, I think we've chopped it all up and we're on to Los Angeles Chargers.
Yeah, one more thing on the LA Chargers. Their Pro Football Reference page still has the initials STG, which is never good, is it, when you've got the old stuff as your initials on the website. You are Albert. One more thing before we wrap up. Obviously, this is a podcast focusing on Seattle, the Seahawks, and sport. Obviously, over the weekend, which was a pretty terrible weekend for things that matter far more importance in the world. So all our thoughts of the Persian podcast are with any Leicester City fans and people in Leicester we have out there, and obviously anyone we have all know in Pittsburgh after the two tragedies that happened in those two cities over the weekend, Adam.
Yeah, well said. I particularly shaken up, obviously, being a Jewish guy myself, by what happened in Pittsburgh. It's every Jewish person's nightmare that would happen. And obviously Leicester is just tragic beyond words as well. And we offer comfort to all those who are mourning.
I mean, as a football fan, what happened at Leicester especially is just the dream for a football fan like myself and a team in the lower league. So yeah, it's just awful, awful watching everything unfold over what was, as I said, a pretty terrible weekend. But yeah, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast. Wherever you watch the game next on Sunday, enjoy and
go Hawks.
So it's the World Series. We wanted to be able to get a World Series, a little shout out or whatnot. So we came up with the idea of me being a pitcher, Doug being a batter. So I had to make sure I hit Doug, and then Doug has to run up, and I'm supposed to be like, yeah, come on, come on. And then we just kind of like battle it out. Kind of like what baseball do sometimes. Thought about it a little bit in London. Like, you never know if we're going to score or how many you're going to score. Because when Demo scored, we forgot. We didn't talk about what we were going to do next. But it was something we talked about at London, but it didn't make the top three. And so we definitely said that we was going to make this the number one celebration this week.